Your Financial Choices may discuss various financial-related topics and thus would like to offer the following disclosures. Lori Siebert is employed by Valley National Group, the Valley National Financial Advisors Group of Companies. Investments are offered through Valley National Investments Incorporated, member FINRA. We inform you that any federal tax, state tax, financial advice, or information contained in this communication is not intended to be personalized or specific in nature, or to be relied upon for your personal situation in any circumstance. The advice and information are not intended and cannot be used as a tax opinion letter, nor used for the purpose of avoiding tax-related penalties. For personalized advice specific to your own situation, we recommend that you consult your CPA, CFP, or attorney.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. I'm a CPA, CFP, and AEP on the web at yourfinancialchoices.com, and you can listen online at wdiy.org. Today is September 23rd, 2015. The markets were slightly lower today, the Dow closing at 16,279, the NASDAQ at 4752, and the S&P at 1938. Tonight, we're talking about trusts and other interesting estate issues. We are live tonight. We will take your calls. Judy Ann's in the studio with us this evening, and we'll answer your calls, take your information, and ask you to mute your radio so you can hear us without the delay and we can talk without confusion. We do discuss general financial planning topics and not specific investments. And while I do typically have a topic each week, you can still ask questions off topic, and I'll do my best to answer. The number is 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. And you can call and talk live with us this evening or off air. You just give your question to Judy Ann. She'll write it down and bring it in. I know it's a gorgeous, gorgeous, lovely evening, but this topic tonight is so important because I think the statistics are less than half of the population has estate planning documents. And this is something that's, if you do it, maybe nothing will happen. How about that? So we're going to talk about some of the nuances of trust, get a little bit more information about them. And we are lucky to have with us this evening attorney Charlie Stopp. Steckel and Stopp has been providing elder law and asset protection services to the Lehigh Valley for in excess of 67 years, with the resources and experience to handle the most complex legal matters with attention to detail and responsiveness that are a competitive advantage. Their direct one-on-one approach has allowed them to develop innovative solutions tailored to fit the needs of their clients. This is especially important for folks who are thinking about trust because one size does not fit all. And we want to make sure you are getting the right information for yourself, whether it makes sense for you to have them or not. We're going to talk about different kinds. Charlie, I want to welcome you to the show.
Lori, it's always a pleasure to work with you and interact with you, and so happy you're feeling better from a physical standpoint.
Thank you.
It's just a real pleasure.
Thank you very much. Yep. Charlie is with the Slatington office of Steckel & Stopp, and he received his JD from Temple University Beasley School of Law and his BS in education from Kutztown University. And that comes through, Charlie, your education experience, your education. And John, our engineer here, is also in education. And I think that is a great element to have. So tell us a little bit about your practice and why that is important to what you do.
Yeah, there's various aspects of our practice. And what I generally concentrate on is the estate planning, estate administration, asset protection issues, mixed with some real estate as well. Others in the firm carry on different areas of practice. But when you're working with clients in the estate planning field, you're essentially an educator, and you're almost a waiter at the restaurant, where you look at all the things that are on the restaurant, all the entrees and the pluses and minuses of appetizers and so on. And once clients indicate what their goals are, at least what they perceive their goals to be, you can go through the menu of choices and make some suggestions and recommendations, but ultimately it's a client's choice as to how they would choose to proceed. But the job is essentially in an educative type mode to provide the pluses and minuses of the various products and devices that are available that might be of help to someone's estate plan.
And sometimes they don't know what they don't know. So the education comes into play there as well, right? They don't always know what's on the menu.
Well, it does, and that's a good choice. It's a good way of handling it. And you look at the menu and just go down the things, and you know, you're interactive with the client, often provide them with a memorandum or written checklist following the initial meeting that they could then use, consider at home, and at the follow-up meeting that helps with further discussions, Laurie. Mm-hmm.
And Charlie has been on the show before, and we were talking about various pieces of estate planning, and we had covered some information about farmland and farmers and different types of situations in estate planning. Tonight, I thought we might concentrate a little bit on trust, but we're also going to, I hope by the end of the show, go through some of the buzzwords that people hear and kind of give them some information about what some of these terms they hear, what they mean. So I thought if we could start with talking about some of the nuances that are around trust, like when we hear people talk about revocable trust or irrevocable trust. A lot of people will hear from their friends or programs, lunches for seniors, come in, you need a trust. So I thought it would be a good idea if we kind of talk about, let's get some definitions out there, revocable, irrevocable. And then as we go through the show, I want to talk about where some of those would apply. Maybe they don't apply always, and kind of help people formulate a little bit more around trust. Folks, if you have questions this evening, it's great to call early. And the phone number is 610-758-8810. It's okay to interrupt us. We're here more for questions. It's our favorite part, answering questions. So the phone number is 610-758-8810. So Charlie, let's start talking about the differences between revocable and irrevocable. And some people say revocable and irrevocable. And I just had to come up with saying one thing. So I say revocable and irrevocable.
Tomato, tomato.
Right. There you okay. go.
Could I just back up a little off our topic from last time? Because there's been a bit of a development and a caveat. Last time, listeners, and certainly Laura, you may remember, mention was made about a relatively new Pennsylvania law that affects inheritance taxes. That was Act 85. And essentially, the law provides that if there's farmland that generates around $2,000 worth of income a year, and that's not much, and that could be from rents, and if there's a relative who dies, and if that farm passes on to certain family members within the same family, the inheritance tax rate sometimes can be zero if it qualifies. There's been a couple of caveats as the law has developed, even though there's no regulations yet. But the way revenue is now applying that is that the farm has to be operated prior to death by a family member.
Okay.
That's a change. And then secondly, another important change is that if the farm passes by trust to a qualified family member, revenue now will take the position that it does not qualify for the 0% inheritance tax rate. That was in debate, and that's revenue's position now. They may not persist in that position as a result of some litigation or appeals, but that's been kind of a position that revenue is now taking. So that does apply to trust planning with respect to agricultural real estate. So if anyone is doing trust planning with respect to agricultural real estate, there are several other ways of accomplishing the result which are clear. But if the trust planning is the route that the client chooses to take, there's a big caveat there that they may have to take an appeal, may have to litigate the issue in order to achieve the 0% rate. So we just want to make sure that the listeners who were listening back in March, I believe it was, Lori, have that update.
That's great to know. And which is one of the reasons why when we're talking about, when trusts are applicable and when they're not, it's also about working with attorneys who are up to snuff on all of the current developments to know if it's going to be applicable to their situation or not. Sure. Charlie, we're coming up on our first break. So I think when we come back from this first break, we will talk about the difference between revocable and irrevocable trust. I love that update. Thank you for that. Folks, if you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. We'll be back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including fee-based asset management. It all starts with personal goals and an understanding of risk tolerance, investment objectives, and the markets. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
American folk music offers a variegated pattern of performers and styles. I'm Tom Druckenmiller, your host for In the Tradition. Together, we'll trace the roots and branches of American folk music from the earliest recordings and performers through today's talented players. In the Tradition, Wednesday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. on WDIY 88.1 FM and WDIY.org. WDIY, Lehigh Valley's community NPR station.
And thank you, John. Welcome back to the show. You're listening to Your Financial Choices. This is your host, Lori Siebert, and I have in the studio with me this evening attorney Charlie Stopp from Steckel and Stopp, who they have offices in Slatington and Schnecksville, and they provide elder law and asset protection services for over 67 years. So we thought it would be important tonight to kind of give some highlights, some information, definitions, some kind of familiarity around some of the terms we have when we talk about estates and people work with trusts and things like that. So we are first going to say, let me say the phone number again, 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. And Charlie, you're going to talk about the difference between revocable and irrevocable trust. And then we had a question from Albert, which we'll take after, if you want to kind of give a brief definition.
Sure thing.
If you can, on revocable and irrevocable.
Yeah, sure. And a little bit of a preface to that question. In cocktail conversation or other conversations, some people will say, well, I have a trust or my grandfather has a trust. Well, that's nice, but what kind of a trust is it? That's a little bit like saying, like, I have a tool. You walk into a hardware store and you want to get a tool. Well, how many hundreds of tools are there? There's a number of variety of trusts. There's many that are commonly used. But to say I have a trust doesn't really mean much until you know the provisions and the kind of a trust. So the two general categories kind of in a binary system. One is a revocable trust, and that is one that the person who creates a trust, called either the settlor or the grantor or sometimes the settlor or the trustor, has a full and complete ability to change and amend and revoke. So if one creates a revocable trust and transfers certain assets to a revocable trust, the person who creates that trust has full and absolute control to do away with it, amend it, change it, and so on. As contrasted with an irrevocable trust, where the person who creates it loses significant control to amend or change the trust. You start it and it flies on its own largely. Now, there are certain provisions that can be changed if it's drafted in a document. Not all creators of a trust will draft these things into a document. But for example, there are usually times when a creator of the trust can change trustees, either based upon some criteria or not. And the basic criteria is for an irrevocable trust to meet the goals of an irrevocable trust. You know, customarily, the successor trustee has to be an independent person, independent of the creator of the trust. There are some instances where the creator of the trust will retain certain rights to change beneficiaries, usually if they're within a certain class of beneficiaries, such as descendants, spouses of descendants, and so on. And there are certain types of trust in which the creator of the trust has the ability to select and change and handle the investments of the trust. There's a couple of other things. Those are the primary ones that one runs into. But the difference between a revocable and irrevocable trust is like you're at the fork of the road. And today is a very important but a sad day for baseball fans, as you know. And when one gets to the fork of the road and wants to choose a revocable or an irrevocable trust, as the greatest philosopher of all time had said, when you get to the fork of a road, you take it. That's a Yogi Berraism who passed away today at age 90.
That was a nice tribute saying that to him. Okay, so we maintain control with a revocable trust, revocable trust and irrevocable trust. I'm from Michigan, different accent. The irrevocable trust, you lose that control, but there are still options for you to retain certain elements of, for example, Charlie said, naming a trustee or kind of redistributing things to children or heirs or some class of heirs. So when we talk about when something is revocable or irrevocable, that is going to go to how it's going to be included for estate purposes, for whether it's federal estate tax purposes or for Pennsylvania inheritance tax purposes. There are reasons that there are characteristics of the revocable trust that will impact your estate planning versus the irrevocable trust. So we can get to that a little bit later in the show, but we want to first help you understand the differences, because if someone's talking to you about doing an irrevocable trust, you're losing control, folks. So you have to be ready for that and know that, you know, you can't give something away and then expect to get it back. So that's the cautionary tale there. Now, we had a call from Albert, and Albert, I hope you're still listening. You were on the road. And Albert said his in-laws have dual citizenship. He didn't say with what country. They have property overseas. In the event of them passing, would there be any taxes passed on to now his level, to Albert and his wife? So his wife's parents have property overseas. Their dual citizenship. If they were to die, would there be any taxes to his wife and her brother? What should they expect and how can we plan? And they also said they owned the property outright prior to becoming U.S. citizens. Now, we don't have a great amount of information here, Charlie, but Albert was on the road, so couldn't call in. Do you want to take a stab at some of this?
Well, let me try with maybe a few more questions that Albert might want to consider. Is all of the property offshore? Is some of it onshore? Depending on the country, it's possible that there may be some treaty conventions that would speak to at least the federal estate taxability of the asset. So that's a question. I'm assuming that real estate is not located in places like North Korea or Cuba. Mm-hmm. But there are some treaty provisions that may impact upon this. If the folks are U.S. citizens, they're almost certainly going to be subject to federal estate tax on the assets. There are some very esoteric trusts that can be created in offshore jurisdictions such as the Cook Islands and Bermuda, which are very secretive trusts and have protective provisions in to avoid various sorts of taxation here in the States. But without knowing more specifics and without looking at the actual trust document, it's a little hard to be more specific.
If there was a trust, they may just own it individually.
Right.
And if it's under our federal estate tax exemption is $5,430,000 each. And if they're U.S. citizens, they may have be under that threshold here.
Indeed.
But they would still have to consider whether or not there would be implications in that other jurisdiction.
In another jurisdiction. And then there are some other specific provisions that if, it happens sometimes that there's a spouse who's a U.S. citizen and a spouse who's a non-U.S. citizen. There are some specific rules then when it comes to federal state taxability when assets pass to a spouse who's a non-U.S. citizen. And frankly, those situations arise rarely. I visited them a few times in my practice, but for purposes of tonight's discussion, I don't want to answer more with any more certainty because it would require a little bit of an update on recent provisions that may be in the law, Lori.
Okay. All right, Albert. I hope that helps, that you can at least maybe ask some of those questions as far as whatever the other wherever the other country is where they hold this property, you could ask what implications might occur there as well. And of course, always take this to your attorney. And we certainly would suggest that your in-laws go and have their estate planning documents updated and it's all taken care of so that you know what to plan for. We're up to our next break. Thank you, Albert, for calling. Folks, if you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. We'll be back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including income tax preparation for individuals, businesses, estates, and trusts. Tax preparation involves more than putting numbers on a return. It requires planning. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
WDIY is gearing up for our 2015 Fall Membership Drive, scheduled to start Friday, October 2nd. Once again, we're giving you the opportunity to buy back several on-air pledge days. If we can raise $17,000 by October 1st, we'll push back the start of our pledge drive by 3 days. That will give us a pledge-free weekend. Please consider giving today. Log on to WDIY.org and make your donation. It's quick, safe, and easy. Thank you.
And welcome back. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices. I have attorney Charlie Stopp in the studio with me this evening. He's from Steckel & Stopp, attorneys at law, and they provide elder law and asset protection services. And we are talking about some just kind of broad information about trust. I believe that it's very important for folks to understand some of these nuances so that you're informed, you can have educated discussions with your family members, and then, of course, seek counsel with an attorney who can help you with this. I think it's important to kind of have some of these discussions to know what's available so that then you can go in and talk to the attorney. And as Charlie said at the beginning of the show, there's going to be a menu and he's going to help you figure out what the appetizers might be, what the entrees might be, and work with you through those decisions. So we just talked about the difference between revocable and irrevocable. And before we had our call, and by the way, folks, if you want to call, the phone number is 610-758-8810. And we love calls, love questions. And you can talk on air or off air, whatever you're more comfortable with. But Charlie, before we took the caller's question, I was suggesting that irrevocable is pretty irrevocable. You know, you still have some control when it's revocable. Irrevocable sounds so permanent. And you were alluding to some of the flexibility that might be available in an irrevocable trust. You said, you know, there may be provisions that an attorney could include in there about maybe changing the trustee or changing maybe a class of beneficiaries. Can you tell me what I want to talk about is when someone makes a decision to set up an irrevocable trust, is there any way that they could still benefit from it? Mm-hmm. And when I talk about the flexibility that's available in it, and I'm talking about you give away something mm-hmm. that you can't get back, mm-hmm. well, what if you still need a little something mm-hmm. from it? Mm-hmm. Can there be some kind of income provision in what we call an irrevocable mm-hmm. trust?
The answer is yes, and there's, again, a variety of irrevocable trusts. Some are used in the charitable sector, mm-hmm. charitable remainder trusts and so on. Some are used in the asset protection sector, and maybe I'll talk a little bit about that because that's becoming, you know, quite common for many folks. And let's maybe touch on that just a little. One of the main risks that folks who are maybe in the elderly or almost elderly category are concerned about is the cost of skilled nursing home care. And the costs of that run, I always say, around $10,000 a month. If you look at the state statistics throughout the Commonwealth, it's slightly less than that. But for purposes of discussion, around $10,000 a month. Which for people who are not subject to federal estate taxes, and again, you pointed out, Lori, the threshold is so high now that many people are not subject to federal estate taxes. And then the other concern is Pennsylvania inheritance taxes, which when assets pass to a child or a grandchild is only 4.5%. It still can be a significant number because it's on a broad base. But the concern about skilled nursing home expenses is a real and profound one for many people who have experienced relatives or friends who've had, you know, large expenses in that regard. So one type of irrevocable trust is kind of an asset protection trust. And some folks will place their primary residence in an irrevocable asset protection trust. But they still want the right to live and enjoy the residence. So, yes, the creator of the trust will have rights to continue to use the residence essentially as their own as long as they're alive. They'll pay the real estate taxes and the homeowner's insurance and take care of the maintenance and the snow removal and lawn and all that sort of stuff. They have exclusive authority to determine who enters the real estate and who doesn't. That's a reserved right. And if in a trust like that, the real estate is sold and not replaced with another residence or other real estate, but if the proceeds of sale are then used, retained in the trust in a portfolio, the trust does continue to provide that the creators of the trust have a right to receive the interest, dividends, the net income from the trust. So the asset is essentially positioned in a type of a management device called an irrevocable elder law trust, asset protection trust. There's different names that different folks use in different venues. But the general purpose of that trust is once a trust is funded and a period of 5 years goes by, during which 5 years the creators of the trust do not need skilled nursing home care, but they may need skilled nursing home care after 5 years. The assets that are contributed to the trust then are, under the current law, you know, protected against having to be used for nursing home type expenses, and generally then will pass pass to the children. But in that type of an instance, the short answer to your question is, can the creators of the trust have certain rights that can be retained? The answer is yes. The retention of those rights, though, will subject the trust principal to Pennsylvania inheritance taxes upon the death of the creators of the trust. But again, that's a 4.5% rate. It's much, much less than the potential cost of nursing home care. And that's for folks who do not have long-term care insurance. I mean, a primary and almost a preferred way of preserving other assets is to be able to purchase some long-term care insurance policies, and you and your firm are so familiar with that and have counseled many people in that regard. But in some cases, meaningful long-term care insurance policies is beyond the budget of many retired folks.
Mm-hmm. Some people might not qualify for it.
And might not.
Now, Charlie, you said it would bring it back in for inheritance tax purposes, yes. And that's because there's this element of retained rights.
Correct.
Is it just that life estate that's included, or the whole entire trust?
Good question. For Pennsylvania inheritance tax purposes, if it's a customary trust that was just described, it'll require that the entire principal is the subject of Pennsylvania inheritance taxes. But if we have a moment now before break,
A couple minutes.
Okay. There's also maybe a benefit, a net benefit to that too, because let's say one takes $100,000 of portfolio assets and puts them in an irrevocable trust. And let's say the basis on those assets, income tax basis, is $10,000. When the creators of a trust die, in Pennsylvania inheritance taxes will be paid on, let's say it's now worth $200,000 because of growth, on the $200,000 at 4.5%. However, the trust and the beneficiaries of the trust benefit from that step up in income tax basis to the fair market value as of the date of death, in that instance, $200,000, and they can then avoid what is usually a 15% capital gain between the cost basis, historical cost basis of $10,000, and the fair market value of $200,000. So it's $190,000 times 15%, and you can run the numbers on that.
Right.
So by paying the inheritance tax and getting a step up in basis, the net result for the client is usually very positive.
But in the case of the asset protection trust, we've kept it out of being available for a resource if the family, if the parents or the person who set it up ended up going into a home and needed government subsidized nursing care.
Yes.
Is that okay?
Indeed. The asset is removed from the category of what's called available assets to the unavailable category. And then usually the taxpayers, the planners or people who are doing the planning have paid income taxes for years to support programs such as Medicaid and medical assistance. And if they can make some of their assets unavailable for those purposes and otherwise qualify, they'll receive essentially the same nursing home care, but funded by taxpayers or other sources instead of their own assets.
Okay. So we're talking tonight about different kinds of trusts, the use of trusts, the ebbs and flows of trusts and using them. And we're going to talk more as we continue the show. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. We'll be back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including estate planning and tax preparation, especially for Pennsylvania and New Jersey residents subject to state inheritance tax reporting. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Do you have a car that you're trading in? How about an old truck or boat that's taking up space? Let WDIY help you get rid of unwanted vehicles and turn them into financial support for the station. It's a simple and easy process. We handle all the towing, title, and transfer, and you receive a tax deduction. Turn your vehicle into the programs you love on WDIY. To learn more, visit WDIY.org or call 610-694-8100, extension 7.
And welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices. I have with me in the studio this evening, attorney Charlie Stopp from Steckel & Stopp with offices in Slatington and Schnecksville. They provide elder law and asset protection services. And we are talking and had just talked about asset protection. In particular, we thought it would be fun tonight to talk about trust, different kinds of trust, how we use them, what's revocable, what's irrevocable. We're going to go over some terms as we go through the show. If you find that there's something that you haven't understood, give us a call. The phone number is 610-758-8810. You can talk live on air with us or off air. Charlie and I think this is a lot of fun. We love talking about this, and we love sharing and educating as well. So again, if you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. Isn't it interesting, though, Charlie, all of the tools, as you said, you know, there's a tool and it could have, we can have 100 tools in the shed, and we have that with trust. But isn't it interesting that people have this as a resource? I tell folks all the time, we think we can't control from the grave. There is certainly ways to control from the grave. And while we think we give up that control in doing something irrevocable, when the document is written in such a way, there are still a lot of controls you could put in, you know, before you let go of it completely. We've talked about asset protection. You alluded to charities. One place I see a need for trust more than ever, which I don't think is on people's radar as much as it should be, is for blended families. You know, we have a husband and wife who've had maybe a couple children together, and then they divorce. The wife goes off, marries, and has a child with somebody else, and the husband might go off and have a child with somebody else. And then maybe they have a spouse who has children from a prior marriage, and it gets very convoluted, and it happens. We see it. So one of the things, I mean, I always have concern for the children first, and we can use trust to help protect our assets for those children that we may have had from the first marriage. Or if we're going into, you know, a marriage where, you know, sometimes what we see is one spouse had older children and they think, oh, those kids are taken care of, they're on their own. And then with the new spouse, they have little ones. And I hate seeing those older children forgotten, because you know what? Deep inside, we're all little kids and we remain our parents' children the rest of our, you know, lives. So can you talk for a minute about what someone might talk to an attorney about with if they have a blended family? What kind of conversation would that look like?
Yeah, the normally early on in a discussion is you look at each of the parties who are now married, presumably, and you ask them, well, who do you want to benefit? And to party B, who do you want to benefit? And is there any mutuality? Who do both of you want to benefit? Because if you look at the context of folks not being maybe in federal state tax brackets for starts, or at least not having the customary bypass or family residuary trust plan set up, but let's say most of their assets are in joint names. Many of their beneficiary designations on 401ks and IRAs and life insurances or each other.
Mm-hmm.
So that if one party to that marriage dies, the surviving party controls all of the assets. And maybe there is an agreement or a tacit understanding that when that second party dies, you know, there'll be a scheme of distribution that they both kind of agreed to. But things happen. That surviving spouse doesn't want to go through life being lonely and maybe has another spouse. And so assets kind of migrate between the surviving spouse of that particular marriage to a subsequent marriage. Or, you know, maybe there's some other pressures that are placed on that surviving spouse by that spouse's, you know, biological or perhaps adopted children to alter that sort of estate plan.
Right. They're not calling me. I don't like them anymore. Don't care that we had agreed to...
You can write the script and you can write the book because you've seen it all. So very good point. So and those things do really happen. I mean, there's a commonality of what happens because of just human nature and human nature of the children and all those sorts of things. So back to your original question, what sort of things can kind of be done? Well, one way, not the only way, other ways include maybe employing life insurance or some other benefits to create a separate estate for desired beneficiaries. But using existing assets, some folks will create one of those revocable or revocable trusts where husband and wife are the creators of the trust. And as long as they both agree, they can amend or revoke it. Both of them have to agree. And they may fund that trust with all or a portion of their assets, depending on, you know, how they want to hedge it. But often a trust like that will provide that when one spouse dies, then the trigger hits and the trust becomes irrevocable and cannot be altered by the surviving spouse. Now, the surviving spouse customarily has certain rights in that trust, often to receive the income from the trust.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, and these are and ors, they don't all have to be included. Sometimes to receive funds from the trust for a standard health, maintenance, and support based mm-hmm. upon a third-party trustee's judgment at mm-hmm. that point. And sometimes you'll find a crummy power, sometimes. Not always, but sometimes, where the surviving spouse can remove a certain percent of the principal of the trust each year or a certain dollar amount up to certain limits. A common scheme would be that if spouse A dies, spouse B, the surviving spouse, may continue as a trustee along with maybe representatives from spouse A's family to kind of make some joint decisions.
Keeps a little independence.
Mm-hmm. Or sometimes there's a third-party trustee. Depending on the family dynamics, it might be best to have a third party who's unconnected.
Mm-hmm.
But that is a way then, so when the second spouse dies, the dispositive scheme that they both agreed upon, and you remember, they're all buyers and they're all sellers on this mm-hmm. because anyone can die first. One doesn't know that. So they're both kind of in the same pond when they're making those decisions in the beginning. Some people will say, Lori, as you know, that they don't care.
Yeah.
And the surviving spouse, we believe they're going to do the right thing. And if they don't, that's okay, too. That can create some hurt and upset among the children, as you alluded to earlier.
Yeah. And one of the things you had mentioned is sometimes they can do all the assets. Sometimes they can do part of the assets. I want to talk in just a second about beneficiary designations and titling. I want to give the phone number one more time, 610-758-8810, 610-758-8810. So when we have a trust, you know, there's assets that go into the trust. Someone has to actually put those assets in the trust name. In your example, folks may not put all the assets in the trust. Sometimes they can have the asset in their name with a beneficiary designation, and the beneficiary could be the trust. So we also just want to add a little cautionary tale about making sure you're coordinating the estate planning using wills, trusts, beneficiary designations, and asset titling. Can you just talk about that for a second? And then I want to get into just a little bit on income tax and then throw out some terms at you. I want to make sure I do that because I thought that would be fun.
Okay. There's a number of different tranches in the process. So if you look at the first tranche for, where there's multiple prior spouses or current spouses and kids from, you know, spouse one, spouse two, and then together. Let's look at that as a first tranche. And that kind of goes back to, you know, most of what we talked about. But by having the documentation in place won't alone do it. It's necessary that the assets either be transferred to such of a revocable trust that becomes irrevocable upon death of one spouse during lifetime. And that happens. It can be done as easily as taking a stock portfolio or a bond portfolio and transferring it to the names of the trustees of John and Mary's revocable trust and so on, as long as it's referenced properly. And that's easy. But then some folks have life insurance policies or those sorts of things. Life insurance policies work really good in that instance where the beneficiary can be the trustees. So there's a death and the trustees collect the life insurance, get it invested, start an income stream for the surviving spouse. Works great. Certain other things like qualified dollars, as you know better than anyone, 401ks and IRAs, they can also migrate to the trust upon death of the owner of that asset. But as you're going to get into with the next question, there are some income tax consequences to be aware of.
Mm-hmm. And you want to make sure that there's the proper language in that trust to allow certain kinds of required minimum distributions over an individual's lifetime.
Exactly.
So I wanted to ask about when we talk about income tax, a revocable trust. Because the person setting up that trust has retained so much control, typically it's taxed just like a regular asset that they have. When we talk about an irrevocable trust, they're giving up that control and they actually become a separate tax entity.
Yeah.
So can you talk for a minute about what that might look like?
Sure.
And how that would coordinate with the beneficiaries of an irrevocable trust if they're getting money or if they're not, because sometimes the money stays in the irrevocable trust. Sometimes it passes out to beneficiaries. So income tax consequences, and if you want to allude to retirement, we got about 3 minutes before
our
next break.
A little potpourri, not necessarily logically presented things, but things that do apply. First of all, if there's a revocable trust that Laurie creates, and Laurie during her lifetime is the trustee, there's no other one else as a trustee, you're allowed to use your own social security number in those instances so that whatever income is generated from a trust like that gets reported on your 1040 and your PA-40, quite easily. Now, if there is a revocable trust where someone else is the trustee other than the creator, or if it's an irrevocable trust, which by definition essentially has a third party as a trustee, then whatever income is generated by the trust is required to be reported on, let's call it a trust income tax return, otherwise known as a fiduciary income tax return, a 1041. And then depending on the provisions of the trust, that is, does the trust require all income to be distributed, referred to as a simple trust, then the trustee would prepare this 1041, show what income was generated by the trust, some adjustments for deductions and so on. But if the distributable net income then passes out to the beneficiary, the income tax consequences also flow to that beneficiary. But there is an intermediary income tax return called a 1041 and a PA-41 for Pennsylvania trusts that has to be prepared. And different trusts provide for different scheme of income distributions, not necessarily to the creator of the trust. It can be to others as well. So, but that return has to be prepared by the trustee, generally once a year.
Okay. So some of the income in the trust may stay in the trust and be taxed at the trust level, income passing out to beneficiaries, flowing to them. will flow to them through a tax reporting document called a K-1, a Schedule K-1. So for folks who are beneficiaries of trust or estates, you might be new to this. Maybe someone just passed away and you're the beneficiary of a trust. You want to make sure that you're asking the attorney, the trustee, or the executor, do you have to wait for a K-1 for filing your income tax? So be aware there may be income passing to you. Folks, we're coming up on our last break. If you have questions, there's still plenty of time. The phone number is 610-758-8810. You can ask questions on air or off air, whatever is more comfortable for you. 610-758-8810. And we will be back in just a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services including portfolio management, tax return preparation, and financial planning for the accumulation years, retirement years, and estate distribution. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
You're tuned to WDIY Allentown, your NPR station in the Lehigh Valley. This is Your Financial Choices with Lori Siebert. Currently 80 degrees in the Lehigh Valley tonight, a low around 49. Tomorrow, Thursday, sunny with a high near 77. Thursday night, a low of 53 degrees. Friday, mostly sunny with a high near 75. Friday night, a low of 52. Saturday, partly sunny with a high near 72. And Saturday night, a low around 51 degrees. Lori and Charlie, it sounds like an ideal forecast, doesn't it?
I was concentrating on something else. I hope it's going to be nice.
You didn't hear that it's going to be cloudy and stormy.
No, I didn't hear that.
Not to worry.
It was all in my head, John. I never stopped thinking. So, folks, welcome back to the show. You're listening to Your Financial Choices. This is your host, Lori Siebert. I have in the studio with me attorney Charlie Stopp from Steckel and Stopp with offices in Slatington and Schnecksville. And we are talking about trust. There is so much to talk about that we could talk about this every week. So we're just trying to give you highlights. This is not a do-it-yourself kind of planning that you need to do. You need to talk to an attorney. It can be very complicated and can have significant income tax implications if not done properly. One of the things we were talking about was the income tax consequences at the trust level when Charlie and I were just off air for a minute. I want to add one other element, and I don't think I had said the phone number again, 610-758-8810. But one element was I wanted to warn people about naming trust as beneficiaries of IRAs. If they do, they really need to work with an attorney to make sure that the trust document has proper language to allow what we call like a stretch out of those distributions. There's a difference in income passing to a beneficiary versus a required minimum distribution. So there's little nuances there. I just want to warn people of that. And at some point, if the documents aren't written with enough flexibility, we could end up having too much income in the trust. And what kind of consequences might that lead to?
Okay. Let's take it in the non-qualified dollar context, first of all. That is non-IRAs, non-401ks, non-qualified annuities. But if it's just normal income, rents, portfolio income that stays in a trust and it's not distributed because it's perhaps doesn't have to be distributed and trustee has certain discretion, when that income for any fiscal year of the trust gets to be slightly over $10,000, and it changes yearly, but slightly over $10,000, I think it's $10,400 this year or somewhere around there. It changes slightly each year.
I look at the tables.
Yeah, same. It's hard to remember all those things.
Yes, it is.
But the income tax rate jumps up to the highest federal income tax rate just on that relatively small amount.
39.6%,
just on that relatively small amount of income. Whereas if the income is distributed to beneficiaries, you know, for beneficiaries to reach that level, I looked at the chart last week and I can't recall the exact.
It's like almost 400,000.
For a husband and wife filing a joint return, it's a little over 400,000, yeah. Maybe 444,000 or somewhere around there before they reach the highest amount.
Yeah, 457,000 for married filing joint.
There you go. Thanks. And that changes.
406 for individual.
So can you imagine that? The highest rate of income trapped in a trust, just a little over $10,000 of income takes you there, whereas if you're married filing jointly, it's that very high amount, Lori, that you just mentioned. So you want to watch that very carefully, or you want to make sure the trustee is very vigilant. And just over the last couple of days, we helped finish some estate planning for some very good planners, very introspective and very bright people who wanted to do some planning for a couple of generations. And I even did some generational skipping planning in the process. I know it's another subject. But one of the things that I asked the client, I said, just do you want me to put this language right in the trust document, just kind of like an alert or a caveat that the trustee should be aware of this trapped income? And, he's an engineer. His son's going to be a co-trustee. He was an engineer. He's a very bright guy and asked a lot of questions. But he even concluded probably didn't hurt putting that language right in a trust as a caveat to make sure that at least in the first or second year of the trust administration, everybody is aware of it, not to fall into that trap.
Right, right. Yeah. And to include language that's flexible enough to allow them some, direction as to what their responsibility would be if they do have discretion in distributing income or not.
Indeed. And there's other strategies, too, as you know. I mean, in certain instances, maybe the trustees will select non-income producing assets or growth stocks or a variety of other strategies that can be taken. But just to point out that there is that risk there and it can be a tax trap.
Mm-hmm. Great. We have about not quite 10 minutes left. So I thought, why don't I throw out some terms at you and see if you can, kind of just give us real general information about it. Law of perpetuities.
Oh, gosh. Let's start with this. Okay. A lot of the law dealing with trusts and estates and so on came from English common law. And just like today, there was always a battle between the tax collector and the taxpayer. And one of the devices used under English common law many, many centuries ago was that normally when a person died, that was a taxable event. Okay, if he had significant wealth. So taxpayers wanted to avoid taxable events. And one of the strategies was to create trust or trust-like devices, which would continue for generations and would not trigger under the law of, let's say, Great Britain, a taxable event. Well, a taxpayer came up with a couple of other rules. And one rule that was applied, the rule may have been there before, but it was applied, was that it was impossible to continue to carry assets in trust for a period longer than, and get this one, listeners, lives in being plus 21 years. So if you're setting up a trust where a grandchild is a beneficiary who was just born and they're 6 months old, the length of the trust could be the length of that grandchild's life or several grandchildren plus 21 years and the trust ends. That had been the law in many states. Pennsylvania abolished that rule of perpetuities, and now there really can be dynasty trusts that can go on and on and on. But think of the context. If you're setting up trusts in the year 800 in Great Britain, you didn't have computers. Not a lot of people knew how to write. So how do you even follow through for more than a generation or so? Nowadays, with all the devices and emails and electronic data and storage and all those things, the ticker notations, it's much easier to accomplish it. And the tax laws here in this country are quite a bit different. So the tax man still does, receive the tax man's due, tax person's due, one way or the other.
Okay. What about attorney general? We hear people say, when do you have to notify an attorney general? When do they get involved?
Okay.
With
well, I'm not sure we want to notify our current attorney general of too much these days.
Okay.
But the attorney general of the Commonwealth has a number of different roles. I mean, a chief law enforcement officer generally, but also sits in the position of a thing called parens patriae of charities. The parent of various charities. And for charities who solicit or encourage contributions, if those charities are named to a significant extent in a will, let's say, those charities generally don't want to be too vocal or too aggressive in questioning whether the gift is correct or not correct, because if that hits the media, it may discourage others from making charitable gifts to such a charity, and the charity may appear somewhat avaricious, which is something that typically they do not want to do. So when there is a certain bequest, and usually the threshold is $25,000 or a residuary bequest, but if the bequest is over a certain amount, the Pennsylvania Attorney General needs to be notified of the gift, and the Pennsylvania Attorney General will typically review the accounting, review the assets, review the deductions to make sure the charity is being treated fairly. Now, oftentimes you can get around that by having everybody who's interested sign off in advance, including the charity, and the Attorney General then gives it more of a cursory look. But the Attorney General is required to be notified when there's a significant gift, usually made by will, but in other contexts as well, to make sure the charity is being treated correctly. Now, there's another context that the Attorney General can act in, and do we have enough time for this one?
About a minute.
Okay, real quickly. Certain charities historically had been known for becoming very close to people on their deathbed. And people on their deathbed are kind of worried about eternity, and sometimes charities would place some pressure on deathbed individuals to alter their wills to include charities that might open up the pearly gates better than Johnny or Mary, their kids. And so the Attorney General can also act in that capacity, and there's also some statutes in place that if a will such as that is made within a certain period of time before death, that gift to a charity can be avoided. It doesn't happen as often nowadays, but historically that there was some abuse there by some charities.
Now, can you skip that if you know, one of the things I like to talk to clients about, if they're charitably inclined, mm-hmm. versus specific dollars in the will, mm-hmm. which might garner the mm-hmm. Attorney General having to be involved, mm-hmm. if they look at especially if there's children too and they still want to be charitably inclined, I say think about giving taxable assets like IRA monies to the charity and give the kids the cash. So if they were to name a charity a beneficiary, either a dollar amount or a percentage amount on an IRA, does Attorney General have to get involved with that?
They don't. I suppose in certain cases of abuse, the Attorney General has enough latitude that they could, mm-hmm. but generally it's not required. And you just hit it on there. Best use qualified dollars for charitable contributions or distributions, because it saves Pennsylvania inheritance tax, in some cases federal estate tax, and certainly income tax. So a smaller gift can be made to the charity, which provides a greater benefit.
Okay, great. How about IRD? I think I have one more minute. IRD, income in respect of a decedent. Yeah. A lot of times people will say, oh, they already paid the inheritance tax. I don't owe anything mm-hmm. else. Mm-hmm. I don't have to mm-hmm. report mm-hmm. anything. Mm-hmm. When might that not be the exact case?
If there's a contract made before death that says, well, I'm going to sell you, my apartment building, I'm going to hold a mortgage, and normally if the person was still alive who made that deal, part of their return is going to be return on basis, part of it's going to be a capital gain, part of it's going to be maybe interest income on an obligation. Well, and that person dies. That income doesn't go away. That income has to be recognized by either the estate or the trust or the beneficiaries there. That's called income in respect of decedent. There are also some deductions in respect of decedent, which can lower some of those expenses. And there's a dovetail in the federal estate tax law that there's certain credits that can be applied when there is income in respect of decedent, so you're not paying federal estate taxes on the income and also income taxes on the income.
Right.
There's an offset there, which does happen from time to time, particularly when the federal estate tax rates or threshold was much lower.
Mm-hmm. So income in respect of a decedent, folks, sometimes you can't get out of paying income tax on certain assets when someone dies. There still might be income tax as well as inheritance tax. Charlie, we're running out of time. How do people reach you?
Well, if they want to reach me, they call one of our offices. We have a website under steckelandstop.com, which provides a profile of the firm. And our main number for calling would be 610-767-3861. But look at the website first to make sure if those who might consider our firm that you can look at the profile to make sure it's a good match for the client.
And Steckel and Stop is STECKELAND for
yes.
and
yes.
Stop, STOPP. So that's steckelandstop.com. And Charlie, thank you so much for being here. It was a lot of fun, went really, really fast, and we could talk for hours on this. Listeners, thank you for listening. Next week, I'm going to have Dan Banks from Silvercrest Insurance to talk about Medicare open enrollment, which is starting October 15th. So get ready. Dan was on once before, and I found him he had tons of information, lots of good information. I was very impressed. So Dan Banks from Silvercrest talking about Medicare open enrollment next week. Coming up next, we have Tom Druckenmiller within the tradition folk music. Remember, pay attention, be proactive, not reactive. I want to thank John for being here and Judy Ann and Charlie again. Thanks so much. Make the best of your financial choices and have a great week. Thank you very much, John, for being here.
And the two of you, too. Charlie, good to see you again.
John, pleasure.
Excellent Lori. Show. And Lori, we are all happy that you're feeling better.
Thank you.
And here's one of your biggest fans right now. And I mean biggest in the physical sense.
Thank you, John.
Tom really Druckenmiller. Nothing but compliments here, Tom. And you're listening to The Happy Place, which is our studios in eclectic South Bethlehem here at WDIY Allentown, 88.1 FM in Allentown and Bethlehem, and also WDIY.org anywhere on the planet. We're ready now to go for some NPR news. And after that, Tom Druckenmiller brings you In the Tradition. The time is 1 minute past 7 o'clock. NPR News follows.
First News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. Pope Francis has concluded his first Mass in the United States. Elevated to sainthood Junipero Serra, the 18th century friar who introduced Catholicism to California, and he repeated throughout the day an appeal for global policies of mercy and inclusion. Francis told the faithful at the